Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eric Maestrino, coming to you today from a very nice Durham, North Carolina. And I'm joined by the wonderful Juliet Liu. Juliet, how's it going up in Ithaca?
Hi, Eric. It's going well. Just preparing for the summer.
Oh, great. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis on the field of global China, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Great. Today we're going to be talking about maintenance, and we often talk about the Belt and Roads Initiative's larger meaning beyond just the specifics of the belt, the road, the infrastructure emphasis. But our guests today go into the material manifestations of the Belt and Road in really specific ways. They think about and reflect back upon what the Belt and Road Initiative means for society, for processes of change, for encounters between China and the rest of the world along the Belt and Road networks. Their project Roadwork is a four-year project with a team made of ethnographers who work along the actual roads that link China with Central Asia. They look at life on those roadsides. They look where people interact and connect. They look at the transformation of the region through infrastructure projects. But they have a really explicit focus on infrastructure maintenance and the lack thereof. They explore maintenance or the need for continuous repair, which, of course, infrastructure projects need continuous repair, but also those human connections get continuously remade and maintained. And they also talk about the decay that occurs where that maintenance is absent, something that I find not only to be a really poetic way of looking at longer-term implications of the Belt and Road, but also a facet of infrastructure development that's often totally ignored when initial projects are proposed and approved. So we're going to have two speakers with us today, Agnieszka Joniak-Luty. And Agnieszka is a professor of social anthropology at the University of Freiburg, and she's the head of the Roadwork Project. Agnieszka's regional expertise centers on China and the Sino-Central Asian borderlands. Joining us also today is Zarina Ormanbatova. Zarina is a social anthropologist from Kyrgyzstan. Zarina is a PhD candidate in the Roadwork team and focuses on social and cultural life of roads in central Kyrgyzstan. Zarina and Agnieszka, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Now, just to start off, maybe Agnieszka, you can explain the Roadwork project a bit because I find it really unique and fascinating. How did that come about and what are the big questions that you guys try to answer in the project?
Yeah, the Roadwork project is a four-year project funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation, and we are now in the last year of the project, so we are slowly wrapping up. But generally, the aim of our study is to do ethnographies, so on-the-ground research on selected important roads and railways that have been built or upgraded as part of the BRI initiative. We want to understand the various local facets that the BRI assumes, depending on the historical, cultural, and social context that the initiative and its projects encounter across Asia. The core team project is made up by five social anthropologists. These are Zarina, who is here with me and who works on Kyrgyzstan, Verena Lamela, who works on dry ports along the China-Western Europe railway line. These ports are Horgos at the Sino-Kazakh border and the dry port of Nuremberg in Germany. And then we have Emilia Suwek, who originally planned to do research in the Tibetan areas in Western China, but had to move to Kyrgyzstan because of COVID and the political situation in China itself. And then Thomas White, who conducted his fieldwork among pastoralists in Inner Mongolia and in Northern China along the newly built Beijing-Urumqi Expressway. And then there is me. I'm the PI of the project. I used to conduct my research on the roads in Xinjiang Autonomous Region until 2016. After that, I shifted my research focus to Kyrgyzstan, to trans-border roads connecting China and Kyrgyzstan. And my interest is in observing and understanding what kind of commodities, ideas, humans, and other actants are leaving China on those roads. How are they received in Central Asia? And what do they do there? The five of us built the core team, and then we have a team of amazing collaborators who bring into the project their knowledge on the Chinese investment, capital, and Chinese laborers, and the Chinese infrastructure projects elsewhere in Mongolia, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Nepal, Myanmar, and Laos. And then we have two amazing historians on the team as well who anchor our research in longer term historical processes. This was very important to me because, as we all know, connectivity, Eurasian connectivity, was not born with the BRI. It's been there. And for us, it's important to see what has changed basically in those connectivities with the BRI.
Yeah, there's a reason why it's a new Silk Road, because there was.
Yes.
there has been an old Silk Road for a while.
Exactly. So we want to see, yeah, what are the continuities, but also what the discontinuities with earlier mobilities are. And for me, it was obvious that for this project, we needed to have a larger team of people because of the scope of the BRI initiative. And this is how the Roadwork project was born, integrating researchers from geography, history, social anthropology, and regional studies. We have two key themes that we all work on. This is place and time. So we try to imagine roads, places where various social relationships, such as technological relations, political, economic, and ecological, they intersect and accumulate over time. This makes every road and railway line that we study a unique bundle of social relations anchored in a specific historical terrain. Another aspect that we study is time, more specifically how infrastructures change over time. I was interested particularly in the mundane change of disintegration, erosion, and ruination, and then on the other hand, the work of maintenance, which is the effort to patch things up, to repair them, and to keep them going. So this is another axis of our research, how infrastructures change in time and the effort of maintenance that tries to slow this change down and patch it up. And I think this is very important, the focus on maintenance and repair, especially in the context of such grand initiatives like the BRI, which appear to be beyond such mundane concerns. Of course, they are not. And we know that in the modernization theory, infrastructures are imagined as agentive objects. So they are expected to do things. You simply have to build them and then they will do things for you. They will bring development, peace, wealth, and so on. I find it fascinating how strong this belief is, even if there are many examples that prove otherwise. In the context of the BRI, as we know, China narrates this initiative as a peace bringer, development tool, and wealth generator. And when I hear such developmental narratives, I find it important to pause and reflect on what it means in this context that infrastructures that should carry these grand visions actually break down and need maintenance.
When Juliet introduced me to your work, she got texts from me giddy with excitement over just like the light bulb went off. It's such a simple concept, but as you were stating, within Belt and Road, within Global China Studies, there's always the creation of new. There's the databases of this project is being built and what are the implications of that? But of course, such a simple idea of maintenance, but like how difficult that is and like the social cultural changes that happen from that infrastructure historically and then also into the future from that and how or if it's maintained and the politics within that, it just opened my mind up to a whole new idea of Belt and Road and infrastructure that somehow I'd never thought of before. So I was really excited when I was introduced to this. And also another thing that I really love about the Roadwork project is that the project puts out lots of different types of materials beyond just academic publications. Is this something first that's typical of anthropological ethnography work? And how do you decide exactly what to focus on and what types of materials to produce and publish as a project?
Yeah, I think it's probably not typical to all anthropologists, but those that we collaborate with closely obviously like to test different and new channels of communicating science. For me, the reason for testing those different channels and non-academic outlets is because I have been personally rather unhappy about imbalance between the labor and money that went into my research analysis and writing so far. And then on the other hand, the impact that it has had on anything. That's why I thought in this project, in the Roadwork project, we have to reach out. We have to do our best to reach out to broader audiences. So we give interviews to press and online media. We give a lot of public lectures to non-academic audiences and also high schools. There was a number of high school students in Switzerland who reached out to me via email to ask me to mentor their graduation papers on the BRI and China. So I thought this is showing, okay, there is some success there. We are getting the message through. One of the larger projects that I initiated in order to create something beautiful but also engaging was the online exhibition Asphalt Lines and Lives, which is going to be launched very soon. It is curated by an international team of European and Central Asian curators. And the aim of launching this exhibition was to test what anthropology and conceptual art can learn from each other and what we can produce together for larger non-academic audiences. And also we wanted to get to know artists from the region in which we work. Another larger and time-consuming project is a multimedia story that we developed in a collaboration with a design studio in St. Petersburg. The story is about ethnographic fieldwork. Our aim was to generate an attractive multimedia story to explain and demystify ethnographic fieldwork by showing how we prepare for it, which tools we employ to collect information, how we manage various conflicting relationships in the field, and so on. So this is our joint team endeavor. And then last, we are also in the process of writing two fact sheets addressed to journalists, policymakers, NGOs, and think tanks. One of the fact sheets will focus on the BRI from the bottom-up perspective. We will zoom in on a couple of projects, discuss the power and discourse of the BRI. And then the second fact sheet will focus more specifically on China's infrastructural activities in Asia in a longer term perspective to anchor the BRI initiative in earlier infrastructural development.
It's a wonderful project. I mean, just even looking at your website, it drew me in. Let's introduce Zarina as well. So Zarina, tell us a little bit about how you came to the topic of studying infrastructure. And I know you're from Kyrgyzstan yourself. What brought you to Zurich and what made you interested in studying infrastructure?
I'm a PhD in the roadwork project. And before starting my PhD, I used to work on various research projects implemented by international and local NGOs in Kyrgyzstan. At some point, I felt like I wanted to gain new experiences and needed to upgrade my knowledge and research skills. And at that time, exactly, I saw an announcement from the Roadwork project about a PhD position. The project was looking for someone from Central Asia, and more precisely from Kyrgyzstan. And the candidate was expected to know the local languages and to be knowledgeable about the country's social, cultural, political, and economic realities. The candidate was expected to have experience in research, particularly to be familiar with methods in anthropology. In general, the subject seemed to be difficult, but at the same time, it was very interesting. It was different from those topics I was working with. And as I mentioned, I was traveling across the country, and I would often complain about the conditions of the old roads and those roads which were under repair. But I didn't know how to study infrastructure from the perspective of social anthropology. I wrote to Agnieszka an email explaining my situation and doubts about applying or not, and she encouraged me to apply for this position. I wanted to use this opportunity to study infrastructure in Kyrgyzstan as a social anthropologist because I didn't know people who were interested in infrastructure from the social scientific perspective. So that's how I became a part of the project, and now I'm writing my dissertation.
That's great. Thanks.
How did you come to study this topic? And specifically, one of your articles focuses on the 450-kilometer section of National Highway 218 in southern Xinjiang. Why is this road and the region more broadly important?
When I started my research in Xinjiang in 2011, this was the first project that I did in Xinjiang, I was interested in exploring the role of transport infrastructure in the Han Chinese settler colonial in Xinjiang. And in addition to this, I really wanted to study asphalt. So I wanted to talk to people about how they perceive asphalt, because this was a rather new material appearing on the countryside, and I thought people will have a lot of stories to tell me about the asphalt, but no one was interested in talking to me about it. So I thought, okay, I need to revise my research design. But at the end, I thought, okay, it was actually a good way to drop asphalt on the way. I'm happy it didn't work out. perhaps Xinjiang is really not a place to study materials. Xinjiang is extremely political, and doing research on asphalt would be like closing the eyes on all the violence, physical and discourse, that is going on in the region. And so instead of asphalt, my research participants talked of other things. And one of them was the question that became increasingly prominent the longer I stayed there, namely how infrastructure plays out in the performances of ethnicity, class, and gender. I heard very often statements like, oh, the Han Chinese, they often travel by train, or long distance buses are favorite means of transportation of the Uyghurs, and so on. So I got intrigued by those statements. And of course, the practices were much more complex than those discourses. But there was obviously something to it. And that was the topic that people talked about a lot. So a topic that mattered to them. So I thought, okay, then perhaps this is something that is worth looking into a bit more closely. So how ethnicity and transport infrastructures intersect in the region, which has been a site of ethnic tensions and diverging notions of nationhood for a long time. So this was one of the prominent foci of my first research. And then further, all the travels through Xinjiang alone in the company of others in different types of vehicles made me wonder about the role of roads as a technology of the state. So I wanted to understand how much state is there actually in those state-built roads. Are roads simply vectors of state power? Does the construction of new roads in China's border regions mean that the state has successfully established access to and control over those regions and people who inhabit them? Based on my research, the answer is very ambiguous. The new asphalt roads definitely transformed travel practices, but I was again and again reminded during my journeys how important local knowledge was in navigating the controlling power of the state authorities. I write about it in my article, Roads in China's Borderlands, which was published a few years ago in Modern Asian Studies. And then the other thing that intrigued me during my long-term field work in 2011-12 and then 15-16 was the question of upkeep and maintenance. And I think the issue of maintenance do not jump to our eyes automatically because these processes take time. The processes of falling apart, breaking, crumbling, and on the other hand, maintenance occur over longer time spans. Even a 1 year long fieldwork stay is not really enough to observe them. You might need to revisit a place over years to see it. And luckily, I was able to do it. And it was the southern section of the National Road number 218 that caught my attention. It's one of the three desert roads that crosses the Taklamakan Desert in southern Xinjiang. And in 2013, when the Belt and Road Initiative was launched, this road became one of the key connections in this Silk Road economic belt that is to connect China with the rest of the Eurasian continent. Commodities from factories in central and southern China travel along this road on trucks in the direction of the Central Asian borders. The road is also the only link connecting the military farms in the desert with the outer world, and is also crucial for the oil extraction in the Taklamakan Desert. I traveled along this road a number of times in different types of buses and collective taxis, and also on foot. And I talked with a lot of co-passengers, drivers, people running the restaurants on the roadside. And then I also heard about this road a lot from my collaborators from Xinjiang University who had their field lab established along it. So I was able to see and hear about this road from very different people. And the question of maintenance in the tense ecological but also political situation of southern Xinjiang was a recurring theme in all those conversations. When maintenance is discussed, we often imagine it as this kind of mundane, invisible work done by maintenance workers who keep the cities up and running. In social anthropology, we also discuss the skills needed for the work of maintenance, the innovation that goes into the work of maintenance. But generally, it is often associated with this kind of loving work of care, with keeping things from breaking down by caring for them. In my research context, all these assumptions were put in question. What I rather saw in southern Xinjiang was how a violent authoritarian state is doing everything in order to maintain its transport and settler infrastructures So in my research context, infrastructure maintenance was in many ways a violent act. And in my article in Political Geography that was published, I think, in 2020, I show how the fragile environment of southern Xinjiang has been exploited since the 1950s in order to build settler infrastructure. And then more specifically, I focus on how the Tarim River and the Bagrash Lake have been drained and are still being drained in order to maintain this desert road and the military farms and settler infrastructures in the desert, which depend on this road. For me, this became then the focus of the roadwork project maintenance as this highly political and also contested endeavor, which in my research site is done to the harm of an ecosystem the size of Switzerland. So this ecosystem is being drained in order to maintain just one of hundreds of roads that are supposed to build the BRI. Today, the maintenance is of course conducted in the name of the BRI too, as this road, as this desert highway, is a part of the transnational road network.
Can you remind us, what years were you working in Xinjiang? Give us a little timeline there.
I did my first field work in Xinjiang in 2011. That was the long-term 10-month field work. And then 2012 was a follow-up field work. And then 2015 and 16, I was there in each year for about 2 months to get an update.
I think it's so important to have people that have done research inside of the borders of China and then start looking outside of the borders, because the projects of state making are so connected. And the central question you ask in the article seems to be, I'm quoting you from the article directly, how many of the projects pursued in the name of the New Silk Road, as which the economic belt is sometimes referred to, will turn into similar modern ruins when the major thrust of the BRI is over. So this concern about what exactly happens to these projects after the paving of those roads actually is successful. How do you answer that in a nutshell for our listeners?
My bet is that many will turn into modern ruins when the major thrust of the BRI is over. I can't prove it yet because the initiative is rather young. But what we see is that in the construction contracts, rarely the question of maintenance is discussed. It's also not being discussed who should come up for the costs of the maintenance, which are substantial. So maintenance costs in a longer term exceed the costs of construction. We rarely hear about it. So the central question is, what will happen to these new infrastructures in countries which cannot fund, which cannot finance their maintenance, or can only finance the most basic maintenance, as is the case in Kyrgyzstan? So on the example of my road in southeast Xinjiang, we see that a road built speedily in a challenging terrain, as we have it in Sino-Central Asian borderlands, might basically need rebuilding after a few years, a decade at most. If this happens in China, it's beneficial for the Chinese construction sector. It keeps it running. If roads in other countries fall apart, facing the lack of regular maintenance, this is still great for the Chinese construction sector, given that they will get the contract to rebuild it, but not for the countries who will have to take new loans on to prolong the lives of those infrastructures. I'm not sure this is a desirable development. And on a more general scale, taking into account the fact that the BRI infrastructures, like all material objects, fall apart and need maintenance, puts the BRI initiative in a very different, more down-to-earth perspective than when we focus on those very brief moments of splendor, like the opening ceremonies when the ribbons are being cut. These moments of splendor are very brief, and then roads assume their very mundane life and need care and investment in order to generate effect.
You know, absolutely, to the, just this concept as a whole. Specifically within China, I just remember throughout the world, what gets built, their thoughts and political dynamics are play very heavily into what gets built and why, and then what is maintained. And you mentioned the megalomania that exists within some infrastructure or project building that exists within China domestically. And I remember I was a Peace Corps volunteer in China, and when I was very wide-eyed, just landed on the ground, my little cold city that I lived in, Guizhou province, like a mile away from the school I was teaching, there was this, all of a sudden, this like weird kind of nice hotel that nobody was ever in. And in it, there was a driving range with a statue, but it was in complete shambles. And I kept trying to like get information as to like, why, what is this place and why is it here? And I learned that in the late 90s, Jackie Chan's NGO gave a bunch of money to get him there. They said they really like golf, so they built him a driving range for his visit. And now it's just this waste of space and resources. And I thought that has really nothing to do other than the fact of why things are being built. And then like, why is this in disrepair now? Why does it still exist? But Zarina, I know you focus within your work on the social life of the roads and the Sino-Kyrgyzstan borderlands. Can you tell us about your work? And maybe specifically tell us about the, maybe mispronounce this, but the Toghuts-Toro roadway in which you focused on?
Yeah, so I conducted my field work in central Kyrgyzstan and in the Toghuts-Toro region. It is located between two large provinces, Jalalabad and Naryn. Many people in Kyrgyzstan have perceived the district as inaccessible and remote for a long time, especially those who are not familiar with the district's history and geographical location. Officially was established as a district in 1935 in early Soviet time, and since then has been part of different administrative provinces such as Naryn, Jalalabad, and because of its administrative instability, many Kyrgyzstanis who perceive the country as roughly divided into north and south find it challenging to locate the district in a particular region. So I should say a few words here about the North-South division in Kyrgyzstan. Concepts are constructed by historical developments and political discourses. This distinction is important during political events today, such as the presidential or parliamentary elections in the country. Politicians use regional identity to gain votes and to win elections. And unfortunately, the public and social media often reproduce the North and South polarization during these events. So how does this division into South and North relate to Toghuts-Toro district? The district is located between provinces that are considered as belonging to two different regions. For example, Naryn is regarded as a province in the north, while Jalalabad is perceived as a province in the south of the country. However, geographically, Naryn is in the southeast of the country and Jalalabad is in the west. During all its existence as a district, Toghuts-Toro was, as I mentioned already, a part of both provinces. However, it's been over 30 years now since Toghuts-Toro is an administrative unit of Jalalabad. And there is a road which crosses Toghuts-Toro and connects it to both sides, Jalalabad and Naryn. The road connection with Naryn then continues to the national capital, Bishkek. This road section is the only overland connection which is open year-round, so which operates the whole year. But the road connecting Toghuts-Toro and Jalalabad is closed in early October due to the weather conditions. It is closed for 7 to 8 months in a year. The district is left without a connection with its administrative center. The situation with the road closure to Jalalabad for more than 7 months of the year played a crucial role in the identity of district's residents. It is also important for those who cannot place the district in a southern region. So the alternative road will be 433 kilometers long. It is still under the construction. It will connect the southern town of Jalalabad and northern town of Balıkçı, passing through the districts Suzak, Toghuts-Toro, Cumgal, and Koçkor. I focus on Toghuts-Toro, and the media have described this new alternative road as the most ambitious project since country's independence. According to authorities, the alternative road should be an alternative and uninterrupted transport corridor between the south and the north of the country. So the road project is part of several international economic corridors and programs. So it is expected to be part of the transit connection from Tajikistan to Kazakhstan with a further connection to Russia. And also it is a part of Central Asian Regional Economic Corridor, which is supported by Asian Development Bank. Partly it is element of BRI as well. A lot of money, hopes and meaning have been invested in the alternative road. I also wondered what hopes and expectations residents of villages along the new road have, which parts of the new road the villagers are waiting for to be finished as soon as possible and why.
I think it's fascinating because, I mean, when we think of the Belt and Road and something that Agnieszka's writing has also said, it's like you see these maps of China's roads cutting through Central Asia. But Agnieszka, what your work does so well is show that since the Soviet era and long before, road building has been happening. And I love this idea that you have the ADB in there, you have Soviet older roads, China coming in as well. It's they're all overlapping and creating their own different roads. And they have these bigger, more vague transport corridors. But in the work that you do and in this article, they're all coexisting. And it's not just like a new paving of roads by China, but this bunch of different actors overlapping. In my understanding, the north-south directions were also a Soviet era thing. You wanted to bring resources from Central Asia up north into the Soviet Union. Are there ways in which the kind of reconstruction of roads bringing Chinese influence into Kyrgyzstan and other places in Central Asia?
China is an important economic and trade partner for Kyrgyzstan. Our country shares more than 1,000 kilometers of border with China. It has two border crossings, Ketchtam and Torogard, which have been operating in the most weakened mode since the beginning of the pandemic, negatively affecting the countries. Moreover, China has been the biggest external donor in the road construction and rehabilitation sector since independence of the Kyrgyz Republic. Most of the investments in infrastructure projects are in the form of loans from Chinese Exim Bank. Now, Kyrgyzstan owes almost half of its external debt to China. And the time of the repayment, which is approaching, have often become a major public debate between politicians, the government and the opposition, raising public concerns about China's influence at the economic and political level. But if we talk about influence from a different perspective, I can share some views from expert interviews I have conducted. The experts were road engineers, representatives of local road construction companies. In their opinion, some Chinese companies were able to build a positive image among the experts and a trusting relationship. Compared to the time when Kyrgyzstan was a part of the Soviet Union, they think that now it is much easier to organize work on infrastructure projects. In Soviet times, to start any work, one had to get permission from the external state unit in Moscow. Logistics, machinery, and all other works usually were delayed. And now the proximity of China makes it easier to transport the necessary equipment and organize work quickly. Experts underline that the expertise of Chinese engineers in infrastructure is good. Although not all Chinese companies, of course, have such an image and credibility, there have been corruption scandals involving foreign construction companies around road projects, including Chinese and Italian companies. Also, the inhabitants of the villages where I conducted my research expressed the opinion that Chinese workers involved in road construction are perceived as temporary residents of their villages. Residents believe that they will soon leave once the work is finished, so there is a little sense of the need for interaction. But they note that they consider the Chinese workers to be hard workers, and next to their ability to work, workers seem lazy. I also think it is important to note here that before the pandemic, the student exchange practice between China and Kyrgyzstan was also at a very high level. For example, Chinese language courses in Bishkek were very popular among young people. Many of those who study Chinese dream of going to China, learning the language, working as a translator, or starting a business themselves. And at the moment, Kyrgyzstan is actively promoting the construction of the China-Kyrgyzstan-Uzbekistan railway. So far without success, but this project is also an important indicator that China has an influence. The project is now one of the priority infra transport projects for the Kyrgyz state and needs Chinese support.
that, as Zarina mentioned, I think among the expert, Chinese technology, Chinese road building know-how is actually appreciated. What we have heard in the interviews is that the Kyrgyz expert might say the price is a bit too high that the Chinese companies demand, but there is no problem of quality. So this was an interesting statement. Mm-hmm. But locally, when we talked with, we talked with a lot of taxi drivers because we spent a lot of time in collective taxis, you could also fear that there is some kind of fear of China. China is very close. When you are in Southeast Kyrgyzstan, in Narin, where we conducted some of our field work, China is very close. It's just, 200 kilometers, and the border is already there. So you hear a lot of rumors about, things happening at the border, about how Chinese soldiers are trying to maybe build some structures on the Kyrgyz territory, how at night they try to cross the border, and so on. So we don't know whether those stories are true or not. It doesn't really matter. What I want to say is that there is a lot of rumors. So on the professional level, I would say the Chinese companies, especially the large Chinese companies, are appreciated for the quality that they bring, for the know-how and technology. And as Zarina said, if something breaks down, China is so close that new equipment can be organized within a day, not like in the Soviet times when it had to be organized centrally. But among the local population, there is also a certain fear of China. So what to do about this huge neighbor? That Kyrgyzstan is so small, and then you have this huge neighbor just 200 kilometers away. And I think, you can't say that China is feared or China is, what would you call it, China is longed for. There are no extreme positions, but there are a lot of ambiguous positions in the society. Some things are appreciated, like the hard work, working ethics of the Chinese laborers, technology, know-how, and so on. And then at the same time, there is a lot of fear about this giant right across the border.
So they're hoping they'll come, build the road as quickly as possible, and then leave, but be close by so that they can come back and repair
it. Probably, that's the essence of it.
Shall I mention that there is a fear, but maybe something comes down, and this thing is, there is Russia leader Putin, to whom Central Asian countries turn and ask for support, just in case China becomes more active in terms of geopolitics. So this is an important note,
The triangulating between the great powers that Central Asia is trying to deal with is fascinating.
That brings us into concluding and thinking about just placing this within a bigger picture. We also recently spoke to Erna Hoffman, who works in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and we reflected with her about the underrepresentation of Central Asia, and also I would maybe include this Xinjiang as a border province, and studying of the Belt and Road Initiative. What do you find that this region can contribute that is unique, and also what is maybe generalizable to conversations about broader global China infrastructure building outside of Central Asia?
In my own perspective, as a scholar of Xinjiang and a person in the process of becoming increasingly familiar with other Central Asian countries like Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, these regions actually seem to be well represented in geopolitical discussions or in debates on security concerns and the Eurasian trade, and in the debates on the Sino-Russian competition in Central Asia. In other words, at the macro scale. Perhaps as the scholar working on this world region, I am somewhat biased, but I think, in my opinion, there is actually no lack of geopolitical analysis of Central Asia in the context of the BRI. I think Central Asia is in the focus of many actors. So, of course, there is China, but there is also the EU, Russia, the US, Japan, Turkey, and the Muslim world more generally. The macroeconomic analysis have shown that there is a huge infrastructural gap in Central Asia. So there is this huge economic potential that those countries and international organizations want to tap into. And Central Asia, especially Kazakhstan, has been rather successful in positioning itself as the connector between China and Europe. Kazakhstan represents itself as the provider of the most stable environment for the construction and operation of transportation links between East Asia and Europe. So I think at this larger scale of things, there is a lot of debate. But yeah, what's missing is this kind of grounded frog perspective that would tell you what is actually happening on the ground, how those projects are faring, which ones are successful, which ones not, and why. What is actually Central Asia contributing to the bigger picture, or what can our research contribute to the bigger picture? I think every region has a specific historical, cultural, and social setting or setup. And in Central Asia, we have this very specific post-colonial context with the past Russian and Soviet colonizations. And then we have this ongoing competition between China and Russia that Zarina mentioned, and also India from the south. Many Muslim investors are active in the region. Islamic practices are changing too. Russia has a strong presence there, but China has become important in terms of trade and other capital relations. So yeah, in other world regions, we will have different constellations of competing powers and then local and translocal histories, which will be probably as difficult as our context is to generalize from. What we definitely can say is that from my research in Xinjiang, we imagine now that so many roads were built and so travel has become easier for everyone. But my research in Xinjiang shows the opposite. It shows that travel today for the large majority of the Uyghurs, but also other non-Han, is perhaps today even more difficult than in the past. So building a road doesn't necessarily mean that connectivity is established for everyone. Today in Xinjiang, we have dozens, or rather probably hundreds, of checkpoints along those brand new roads that are to keep the unwanted subjects and people off those roads. The state permits only specific categories of citizens to use the new road freely. Construction of transport infrastructure does not automatically bring connectivity. Quite on the contrary, it may actually cement some forms of stuckedness and exclusions. I don't know, Zarina, do you have some examples?
Yeah, so my research shows that people long for certain roads that connect them with desired directions. Not every road is welcomed, and some roads are feared and unwanted because they connect us with a place or people we don't want to be connected with. And that's why some roads to particular directions are cared for and the others are left without maintenance and attention. Also, what I see from my research is that BRI is not monolithic, that different various actors are engaged in construction and maintenance of infrastructure projects in Central Asia, and they are assigned to different kinds of programs, international and regional, and the funding source we've received from different financial organizations, and diversity of contractors and subcontractors, including local construction companies, also indicates that this is a diverse project with different actors. And it is the international, or rather Western media, that has made the image of BRI so strong and dominant. Also, I would say that BRI in Central Asia in Russian-speaking circles is referred to by a different name, the very first name Obor. And also we observed that initiative presented possibilities for Central Asian countries to reimagine themselves as the center of such a large and significant initiative. So it is often evident in texts of local media or development strategies, and mostly in tourist brochures. For instance, in those texts, countries use such sentences, Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan is the center of the ancient Silk Road. And now, since the new Silk Road along the old one is being revived, the Central Asian countries are using the moment and this notion of centrality to be one of the main actors in the new Silk Road initiative.
I love that. That's really interesting. Agnieszka, go ahead.
What we see in our project is that the BRI discourse ascribes agency behind the initiative to China. But when you lift the lid of this large pot, the large BRI pot, you realize that various actors and investors are actually present and competing with each other for the realization of actual projects. That's what we perhaps can suggest based on our research, is that China doesn't seem to dominate the BRI initiative in the way that the name and the globally circulating discourse on it would actually suggest. This is something that transpired in various research sites in Kazakhstan and in Kyrgyzstan and also in Mongolia. That would be perhaps one of the lessons that we can take from Central Asia, to look more carefully into the actual projects and try to understand the funding structure of this project and the various actors and investors that are actually competing for the contract. It seems that it's all much less China dominated than we seem to believe.
I think that's a great observation.
I think it's one of my pet things, and Juliet and I talked about that a lot during our episode where we talked about our writing, and it's so very true. These things are complex, and looking at things at the project level makes things more interesting. Agnieszka, Zarina, thank you so much for joining us in the Belt and Road Podcast. We stick around for recommendations.
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay, great. You've been listening to the Belt and Road Podcast. Again, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis on the Belt and Road Initiative, and of course, join the discussion. We love hearing from you. And we also love getting the 5 stars on the iTunes or whatever. We've grown a great listenership. We love you all that are listening and want to be able to grow it. So you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Belt and Road. Yeah, so let's move on to recommendations. Where do we want to start? Agnieszka, do you have something, do you want to tell our listeners to what you've been reading, watching, listening to lately that you want to share with others?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. So the first thing that I'd like to recommend is an open access journal, Roadsides, that I co-manage. It's not per se focused on the BRI, but it is more broadly devoted to the social science studies of infrastructure. And I think this can be useful to anyone working on the infrastructure of the BRI. So that's my first recommendation. And then the second is the blog Belt and Road in Global Perspective, hosted by the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. And I really love the pieces that were published in this on this blog on the various facets and manifestations of the BRI. There were also some roadwork collaborators who published in that blog, Galen Martin and Hassan Karar. I would recommend these two things. What about you, Zarina?
I want to invite listeners to read our article, Welcome and Unwelcome Connections, Traveling the Post-Soviet Roads in Kyrgyzstan. Agnieszka and I wrote and published in the journal Central Asian Survey. We talk about how infrastructural connections become a place where people's identities can be confirmed or challenged. We also show how inhabitants of central Kyrgyzstan maintain their mobility through smartphones, the internet, and personal connections to desirable places, while the state has ceased to provide connectivity. And my second recommendation is the documentary about Nepalese mountaineer and his team of Nepalese Sherpas as they attempt to climb all 14 8,000ers in 7 months. They also aim to set a world record. The documentary's central character demonstrates determination and endurance. It was very inspiring for me. And the message of the film was also meaningful. It's about equality of representation.
And those are great recommendations. Eric, what do you have for us?
To be honest, this is actually, for all the listeners, this is actually the third podcast I've recorded this week, which is something we usually don't do, so I've been running out of recommendations.
I don't believe that. You always have a million recommendations.
Well, of course. I have a recommendation. I just don't have one on China stuff again. But in 34 years old, and with COVID time, spending a lot of time at home, I'm trying to think of a better word for this, because it's certainly not a quarter-life crisis, because I'm not feeling a crisis. I'm actually feeling really great. Like quarter life celebration or third life celebration of just the idea of continued growth and how we can continue to learn about ourselves, learn about people around us and grow. I've been within that context, I've been really loving artists who were famous or were known to do something at one point in time, maybe earlier in their life. And then later in their life, they still come out and do something very different, but it's also still culturally impactful and meaningful. They don't rest on their laurels and just play the hits. And within that context, there's an album called Bish Bosh by Scott Walker. Scott Walker was part of the Walker Brothers in the 1960s that came out right before the Beatles mania. And he had one hit song that for like a year or two, they were like as famous as the Beatles in America and the UK. But he shunned the limelight and he just went away and basically did that for like a decade. And then he came out with four albums of covers of French Baroque songs. And then he went away for a while. And then in the 2000s and 21st century, he came back and made these avant-garde albums. And the last one he ever made was called Bish Bosh. And one review, it talks about it as Bish Bosh starts with 30 seconds of what sounds like a jackhammer and ends with a funeral rendition of Jingle Bells for solo xylophone. In between, there are tense silences, horror movie strings, and a 20-minute songs without verses or choruses. And at the center of it all is an old man wailing. I love it. It's haunting, but it's unlike any album you've ever heard before. It's never too late to change, and you can always grow, and you can always try and do new things, and it's very inspiring. Scott Walker's Bish Bosh.
Nice. I totally thought you were going to recommend Mariah Carey's revival in All I Want for Christmas Is You, but I think that's equally good.
It's pretty close to each other. Yeah. But anyway, but Juliet, what do you have?
I'm going to post a few things. I've just been reading on, or have been meaning to read even more on, sand extraction in the Mekong. It's a really cool topic, a really terrifying topic. It's often not thought of because sand just gets dredged up by these big ships and by these like tubes sucking sand out of the Mekong. It gets transported to places like where Agnieszka and Zarina work in Made Into Roads, basically, or skyscrapers, or all different types of concrete. But think about sand. Next time you're driving down a road, think about how much sand gets extracted. And I'll post a few things that are very cool photojournalist projects on sand extraction in the Mekong.
Isn't it like the number two legally traded material in the world? There's like
black
lots of
markets
mafia
of
money
sand,
and stuff,
which is insane because how do you transport sand in a secret way you don't? It's just a really crazy topic.
Great recommendation. Thank you.
We're so grateful to have you guys on. We're going to link to a lot of your great work that we've talked about today. Thank you again for being on the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you for this very kind invitation.
Thank you very much.